what's made you who you are? It's a straightforward enough question, one that pops up more or less and with more or less urgency in most of our lives. And it's a question for which most of us have straightforward answers. Our families, usually. Maybe our teachers, or maybe some important personal event, the death of a loved one, the onset of a disease. Sometimes we may nod toward history, the Depression, the Vietnam War, the attack on the Twin Towers. If we grew up on the south side of Chicago or came of age on a farm in Idaho, we might see those places as crucial to the adults that we've become. These are the kinds of things we expect to find in memoirs, that genre that tries to make sense of our experience in all its vast, buzzing complexity and infinitely baffling richness, and tells us the story of a life. Not so with Nicole Walker's new book, Quench Your Thirst with Salt. Walker has written a memoir of sorts, but one in which she's invited in all of that buzzing and all that bafflement, with the aim not of telling the story of her life so much as capturing the surprising nature of being alive. Walker takes this question, what makes us who we are, and looks in places we'd never expect. She finds, for example, that she can't fully understand how her father's excessive drinking has shaped her unless she can also understand how water itself shapes us, how it literally is the material we are, and how the water she drank as a child in the Salt Lake Valley of Utah came to exist in a landscape that was once a desert. William Blake may see a world in a grain of sand, but Walker sees a self in a city's sewage system, an element of carbon, or the struggle of salmon making their way up a concrete spillway. Quench Your Thirst with Salt is a mashup and shake-up of memoir, social history, nature writing, confession, chemistry, geology, collage, and brave speculation, all brought together by a lively wit. Nicole Walker, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you so much, Eric. It's great to be here.
You are the author of a recent book, Quench Your Thirst with Salt, and I cannot wait to talk about that. It is a beautiful and powerful book, fascinating and really something all its own. But before we get to that, I'm just kind of curious if you could tell us a little bit about, you know, what kind of writer eventually gets to this point, if we can know who's the person behind this book. I think it'll give us a better sense of how to go into it.
Definitely, Eric. I mean, I think this book is made out of my experiences and my attempt to reconcile, you know, what my life was like and has become. So it makes sense to give some sort of traditional background story. I was born in Salt Lake City, Utah, to parents who had been baptized in the Mormon Church, but were not, in fact, members of the LDS Church when I was born. They'd moved to New York City for a few years, and my dad went to Columbia, but they came back because the engineering industry had been in a bit of a recession. So they came back and my dad found a job back in Salt Lake. They would have stayed in New York City their whole lives, I think, if they could have. So I grew up in the suburbs of Salt Lake City. And when I turned 17, the first thing I wanted to do was get out of Salt Lake. I found it claustrophobic and culturally stunted and repressive in a lot of ways. You know, I was a very rebellious teenager, listened to Crass and Subhumans and all the punk rock music and wore safety pins in my ears for a couple years. So I wanted out as fast as I could go. And I moved to Portland, Oregon, where I went to Reed College, where everyone had safety pins in their ears, or at least the equivalent of in tattoos or wild haircuts. And felt, you know, fit in really well, I thought, at Reed. And it was the first time where I found people who were equally interested in intellectual stimulation with sort of political and rebellious tendencies. Reed was a great experience, and I loved Portland, and I stayed in Portland. I got my degree in English, worked at a number of nonprofits, the Oregon Humane Society, where I was the computer guy, Oregon Wine Growers Association, where I was the administrative director for a while. You know, I popped around nonprofit to nonprofit, and that could have been my life for a while, but I really, you know, even after I graduated, continued to write and continued to try to get work published. And I was dating a guy who was just graduating from Reed, and he wanted to go to PhD school. And so we both applied, and I said, yeah, sure, I'll go get my MFA. I'd really like to do that, and I'll come right back to Portland. So he applied, and I applied. We both got into University of Washington, and we both got into University of Utah. But he decided not to go to University of Utah, and I decided not to go to University of Washington. And so we parted ways. And that this is insane that I decided to go back to Salt Lake City, this place I'd tried so hard to escape. But Salt Lake had changed, and I had changed, and I wasn't so narrow-minded in my own way, only seeing Utah from this very small perspective. But having come back from Portland and seeing, you know, even Portland, perfect Portland, has, you know, different elements of political spectrums and different different kinds of people living there. It wasn't just Utah that was so conservative. And also, one thing that's so great about Salt Lake City is the subculture is pretty intense. In a lot of ways, the subculture in Portland is the culture, right? And so you're not rebelling anymore. You're just kind of part of the regular people. In Salt Lake, there's still that sort of unique element to being different. And I like that about Salt Lake City. And Salt Lake City proper was an up and coming in a lot of ways kind of place. So I got back, got my MFA, met my soon to be husband, and decided I would stay and I would get my PhD. And I stayed in Salt Lake for 8 years. And finally, when I had to go, because eventually you get a PhD and they want you to get a job and get out of there, I was heartbroken. It was amazing what a 180 I had made in my perspective about Salt Lake City and how much to this day I still love that place. So I think that comes up a lot in the book, that difficulty of growing up in this hard place and having to leave this beautiful place. The city is a place of contrast. The state is a place of contrast. And I think because I grew up there, I'm also sort of full of contrast.
I think that it absolutely comes across in the book. And there's definitely a deep love for the Salt Lake Valley and the culture there. And I think I use the word love because if you use it correctly, it encompasses the light and the dark. It's just not happiness and, you know, naturalist writing that's celebratory, but all the kinds of vexations and ambivalences that come through. One of the things I certainly wanted to touch off on right from the outset and want listeners to know is that even as we get this personal memoir of yours, which I think is completely apt for understanding the book, your approach is really to write a memoir that places you as an individual person, as a self, as a body, most particularly in the landscape, indistinguishable ways, really. It's as though it's a history of the self and a history of the place simultaneously.
Eric, I think you're absolutely right to say that's the attempt of the book and the attempt to encompass or bring in parallel the idea of the body being shaped by this culture, by her own experiences, by her boyfriends, her dad, and her mom. And then this landscape that's so, in some ways, managed by these incredible people who were able to reconstitute mountain streams into valley parks and valley fields and valley agriculture. But the shaping is, if you look at a human with that sort of distant perspective, that you look at the Salt Lake Valley landscape, the parallels, to me at least, when I was writing the book, were easy to make. And, you know, as I come to prose through poetry, and that associative leap that you're allowed in poetry is sometimes not as embraced in prose. But one of the techniques of the book is to toggle back and forth between stories of the self and stories of the landscape, stories of growing up and stories of the environment in a way that makes them not seamless, because that would be a lie. You know, there's a huge seam between these two things, but makes them conversant with each other. And in that conversation, and it's only to me in that conversation that I arrive at any of the insights that I do. You know, if I tried to write the memoir, just a straight memoir, I don't think I would have arrived at any of the epiphanies, if that's, I don't know if they're epiphanies, but at least any of the moments where I was astonished, like, oh, I never thought of it that way, without having the other story bear upon it, the story of the environment, the story of the landscape. And to me, even the process of writing or that form is another parallel, that by using these two stories to push against each other in the same way that the Salt Lake or the Wasatch Fault pushes the mountains against the valley, or the way that the dominant culture pushes against a young girl growing up in this town, that the form itself pushed me in ways that allowed new ideas sort of to pop out.
I think this is a great moment to try to describe for listeners how the book works, because I think you're right that its form enacts the way that it's approaching its subject. And when I try to describe it to people, I say things like, well, it's a collection of essays, but that won't tell you much. Maybe it's a memoir of a landscape. Or maybe it's a geological and cultural history of a self, or maybe it's both or not, because sometimes you pop up in Minnesota. So how do you describe the book to readers who are encountering it for the first time?
I love that idea of a geological history of the self, or a description of a memoir of the landscape. Those are exactly the terms I would use. And again, it's that idea of coming in from two ideas, two contrasting modes. One is that desire sort of to confess and to figure out your past through, you know, with perspective, with some distance. But, you know, I guess I would describe the book not as a series of vignettes, although that is one way to think about it, because there are so many sections within each essay. But to think of it as a through line, through which you could say, okay, this is the way pressure is building against these two ideas, and that if we put enough pressure, we will make some sense out of things. So it begins, you know, in pretty chronological order, begins with me growing up and finding out that my dad drank a lot more than I knew. Moves to experiences that I had when I was really young with boys, growing up in that, having boyfriends, having them sort of dominate a lot of my ideas and a lot of my thinking for a while until I sort of escaped that. Moving into meeting my husband and finally getting pregnant when I, you know, was in graduate school. And so in a lot of ways, it's traditional in its trajectory. And then again, it's like mountains being pushed up by tectonic plates, up come these other stories, these other investigations or research elements that to me say, okay, but this is just one person's story in a million people's story. What makes it different, or what makes it, what allows me to approach this material in a way that leads me to new insights and hopefully the reader to some new insights? And by doing pushing that, the environmental story, I'm saying, you know, we're all part of this larger picture, and humans are part of nature too. And we are pushed by forces that we can't understand, or we can only understand with some sort of study and perspective, in the same way we can only understand the way, you know, an earthquake shimmies it after it happens, right? We only record the seismic disturbance after the fact. And we only recognize it after the fact. And so it's with that sort of distance that I think I can achieve that distance. This is a better way to say it. I can achieve the distance on the self by incorporating some of that knowledge, that research, that data, that more distant sort of information. That pushes the book, I think, into letting the personal story situate itself in something a little bit bigger, and for both stories to be told with more perspective, I think, than I would have gotten had I just written it straight from, you know, this happened to me when I was 9, this happened to me when I was 11, this happened to me when I was 14. I think that pushing it away a little bit helped me see it in a new light, in this new landscape.
I think it's not just another story of growing up, right? I, that's embedded, as you're saying, in this, but we see alongside kind of the memories that one might expect in a memoir, things like, you know, articles that presumably you found online or in a magazine, NPR reports. There are rules, there are recipes, there are the odd facts about water or equations about elements. There are old letters that pop in and out. There are even some tables where you can compare certain sorts of things. And I think, you know, you've been talking about the insights that the book comes to, and I think that there's also a generosity in the way that the book's put together, that when you bring these different perspectives into just kind of what it means to grow up and what it means to be a person, there's room for the reader to turn over a lot of the things that you're presenting. You know, there are a lot of questions left undone that I think implicate and invite the reader to think about who we are in ways that I wouldn't expect in encountering a memoir, if I imagined a memoir as a story about a person.
Well, and, you know, it comes through, I think, a lot of it in terms of ways that we assume certain things will affect children. So alcoholism will affect children in this one way, and having sex too early will affect children this other way. And again, this comes from a pretty rebellious spirit that says, yeah, maybe there's always bad things that come from being raised by an alcoholic. And there's always bad things about having sex too young and being, you know, too interested in what boys think about you. But I also wanted to see these things in a different way. Like, I don't have that sort of standard belief system that says, okay, if you're raised by an alcoholic, you must join Al-Anon. I think it's much more complicated than that. The reason to bring in those rules, the you know, Utah liquor laws, or the images of the Thistle landslide, or the recipes, is to sort of mess up that standard thinking that this, you know, if this happens, if A happens to you, then B, then you must do B, so C results, and that things are not such an equation. I think another reason to bring in those extraneous materials, that sort of multimedia interruption, a lot of it is when you're working on pretty emotional behavior, emotional experiences, sometimes you just need a break from yourself. It might be a bit of a coping mechanism. That used to be how I thought about it, for sure. But the more I've been thinking about how memoir works, or how nonfiction works, is that it's, in some way, you have to dissociate from yourself. You cannot re-experience all of your childhood again without sort of separating from the character you're creating and creating this narrator type person who's watching the character move around on the page. That's a really weird thing to happen in your brain. And I think a lot of the ability to do that comes from some early, you know, trauma that I could dissociate and see my family as if on TV, and I watched them, including me, walk around and behave in a certain way. I think there's, you know, my colleague Laura Gray Rosendahl wrote a book called College Girl. And the first half of the book is about her being raped in a college and how she calls herself college girl for years. Instead of saying I, she actually uses the phrase college girl. And the second half of the book is about how she reconciles that college girl back into the self, into the I point of view. And I think it's a great study, and as well as a great book, but a great study in how memoirs can, how they can work, and how you can make them both artistic and emotive, as well as smart about how the brain works and about how we see ourselves. So my strategy, as opposed to breaking the book into two halves like Laura Gray Rosendale did, is to use that research as a kind of lens, or to use that those imported bits of material straight from the web to say, look, we are looking at this individual through a culture, right? We're looking at them through a list of rules, or we're looking at them through a recipe for this is how you make humans, you know, this is how you make fish, this is how you make humans. And by bringing those multiple lenses into the book, I feel the self becomes multiple. It's not no longer just Nicole Walker writes about Nicole Walker growing up. It's like, oh, here's a girl on the scene, and we can see her through the eyes of a landscape, we see her through the eyes of a cougar, or we see her through the eyes of the story of the wolves. That these different perspectives are insisted upon, I think, because of the material, the extraneous material that's brought in.
And I would say that I would add to that. So yes, absolutely. There are these very weighty matters that come up in the book. I mean, that there's violence. There's a deep investigation of desire and how that works. I think, you know, kind of how as a child we reckon with our parents and try to make sense of that legacy. One of the lenses, one of the vantage points certainly, is a very dry sense of humor in which you will ask the reader things like, would you rather be a grain of sand that has resulted from erosion, or would you rather be built up from brine shrimp poop? And you just lay that out there. So it seems to me like you're not beyond taking a certain kind of wink at some of this material even as you move forward with it.
Absolutely. And that's a very, that's probably just part of my personality. I'm just generally an optimistic person. I think most things are funny, you know, even traumatic events with some distance, again, is just kind of, you know, again, dry, ironic, wry, like, I can't believe this is the way the world works, but this is the way the world works. And that, you know, you can't try for that kind of humor, I don't think. It's a matter, again, I attribute a lot to the method of the book. Like, I don't think, again, if I'd written it as a straight memoir, it would have been, I think, so much more serious. But, you know, if you're jumping around and talking about fish, trying to get up a fish ladder, and talking about the thistle landslide and your hernia operation, and then 15 pages later, you're talking about, you know, the way that your mom, that your fellow students were throwing snowballs at your mom, that you're like, by bringing all of those scenes sort of together in your mind at the same time, there's some sort of absurdity to it. Like, this is a crazy world. And it's a crazy life. And the humor, I think, comes from bringing all of those things together in a way that is not a traditional narrative arc, but through the benefits, I think, of what would be more a poetry sensibility. That associative leap allows for those funky things to jump in, and to me, that's sort of where the humor comes from.
I would say, you know, the essayist in me thinks, well, that's how the mind works, right?
Exactly.
Well, I think we've given a kind of description. If I were listening at this point, I might love to hear a small excerpt from the book just so I could get a taste of the thing itself. Would you be willing to read a passage or two for us?
I would, Eric. You know, I've been thinking a lot about this essay, even though it's not the one I generally read when I go to readings. I like to read the final essay in the book, Where the Wild Things Are, because it's shocking and people are like, I can't believe she's talking about this in front of her mother. I read it in front of my mom. My poor mother has suffered deeply. You know, and I'll read it, and the people are rapt with attention at that essay, but it goes on for about 20 pages. I think it sort of sums up the book in a lot of ways. So I will let the audience maybe pick up the book and see if they are interested in reading that last essay. But I was going to read a little bit from this essay, Thistle Landslide, because I think it does a good job of showing how, as you so beautifully put it, how this is a memoir of the landscape or a geologic investigation of the body. This is the Thistle Landslide. What has the power to reshape? Outside sources, usually, backhoes and Big Macs, concrete and liposuction. But what can change topography from the inside? For instance, a hernia is a weakness in the wall of the abdomen. Some hernias are present from birth, while others develop later in life, often as a result of persistent straining. Hernias tend to occur at places where there is a natural weakness in the wall of the abdomen, such as in the groin, called inguinal hernias. Hernias occur in both men and women, although inguinal hernias are much more common in men. Another example of change made from the inside. The Thistle landslide began moving in the spring of 1983 in response to groundwater buildup from heavy rains the previous September and the melting snowpack for the winter of 1982 to 1983. The ground became saturated with water, destabilizing rock and dirt from underneath. Within a few weeks, the landslide dammed the Spanish Fork, obliterating U.S. Highway 6 and the main line of Denver and the Rio Grande Western Railroad. The town of Thistle was inundated under the floodwaters rising behind the landslide dam. Total costs incurred, direct and indirect, by this landslide exceeded $400 million, the most costly single landslide event in U.S. history. Cause. When I was three, my twin sisters were born. Apparently, in a moment of iconographic cuteness, I asked my grandmother when I found out they were twins, why so many? Indeed. Many times my mom and dad must have asked themselves that same question. I can't imagine how they changed two sets of diapers, or how either parent slept when one twin would fall asleep just as the other woke up, or how they kept track of how many bites of applesauce each one ate. I always imagined my mother breastfeeding both of them at the same time. She said she did, once in a while. But unlike the image of in my head of two babies cradled in her arms, crossing her chest, she showed me how she held them, heads in hands, elbows wide to her feet, feet pointed outward. It's called the football position. My mom must have felt like a tapped keg. Send them up, she would say, and the twins would drain her double Ds down to a deflated C, like football players who drain their 40s on Friday nights. I did, however, after my initial surprise, adapt to their twinness quickly. When my mom wants to let me know how much she appreciates me, she reminds me of how I'd run and get their bottles or find them a blanket. I thought the twins were super fun dolls. I like to hold them in the cute way, with their feet crossing in front of me, their heads in the crook of my elbows like koalas in the crutch of bamboo. When they were older, I started to carry them everywhere, even more koala-esque. I carried one little twin in my arms and let one climb onto my back. We'd go up the stairs and down the stairs, outside into the backyard and up the rock path my dad built to the garden and down the deck and then across the street to where my mom played bridge and where she would tell me to put them down for once. You're old enough to walk. I was going to break my back. But I loved doing it. I loved that they loved it. I played favorites, alternating daily, letting the best one of the day, the one who smiled at me the most or made the best joke or gave me half of her peanut butter cup, ride in my arms. I tried to be fair and trade back for front evenly, but that was harder to keep track of than how many bites of applesauce each one ate. Cause. In 1983, there was a big flood that affected all of northern Utah, a flood that transformed the landscape, even the cityscape. The concrete, man-made roads and bridges buckled and broke as the snow melted and headed toward the Great Salt Lake any way it wanted, channel, riverbed, waterway be damned. Hills came down and rivers overflowed. City Creek, Salt Lake City's main water source, was redirected over ground and around the downtown to State Street, an eight-lane major thoroughfare. Now, 20 years later, I live right by City Creek, and I wonder where the water has gone. It comes down the canyon, runs into the park, and then disappears. How could that same river have possibly ended up in the middle of the road teenagers dragged on Saturday night? In 1983, it was lined with sandbags. People fished from the sidewalk. One of the few places permanently affected by the landslide was Thistle, Utah. Thistle, in the first place, was already practically ghostly by 1983. As a railroad town, it had ebbed and flowed with Union Pacific's tides. The apex of its population stood at 600 people in the early 1900s. By the time the landslide hit, Union Pacific was mostly happy to find a way out of the money-losing line. As the speed of locomotives had increased, the need for stopovers and refills in small depot towns had lessened. By 1983, only 50 people called Thistle home. Symptom. I was showering in my mom and dad's bathroom when my mom opened the shower curtain to hand me a washcloth and noticed the lump. She asked how long it had been there. I did not like her looking at my vagina. I told her as much. She kept looking anyway. I told her I was okay and showed her my neat trick. If you pushed on the lump, it went away. I thought she would like that. It was a little like ironing. Press it down and the protruding wrinkle goes away. She did not like it. She called the doctor. symptom. For a while, those floods transformed the riverbeds and the canyon floors, but the most dramatic changes came from underneath. As the water sopped into the sandy ground far above in the mountains, the underlying valley aquifers began to fill. The aquifer just above Thistle filled to the brink, and then it bubbled over like any lid that tries too hard to hold the contents of its burgeoning cup. The land that capped the groundwater spectacularly split from the underlying ground and steamed right into the town of Thistle. Thistle, dry, pokey, brittle. Nothing went about it. Not usually. Not until 1983, when the rules changed, and the lid was no longer tight, and the cup no longer big enough, and the whole side of the mountain shifted its weight up and over, then down on the town of Thistle. And then the essay goes on to describe how Thistle really did become a ruined town, which is paired with the hernia surgery I eventually had to have. And the idea that maybe that sort of exposure early on made me, you know, particularly immodest, possibly, later in life.
And what I love is the very next sentence is, how literally can you take the metaphor between the land and the body? And so, you know, the book is constantly interested in how it goes about doing what it's doing. There's not much naivete in many ways here.
Absolutely. I should have read that line, Eric. But it's exactly, you know, it is a self-conscious memoir, I think, in a lot of ways. And that self-consciousness, you know, as the book progresses, is much more investigated. You know, what makes somebody self-conscious, as you said earlier, you know, what makes people desire a certain kind of life or desire certain people, different places to live. At the end of the book, in the Where the Wild Things Are essay, which is a pretty big leap in time, right? I mean, this book goes from this age, you know, about 10 until, 28 years old and pregnant with my daughter. And the difficulty in trying to see, okay, how much am I imprinting all of this self-consciousness onto my daughter? How much am I imprinting all of this desire onto my daughter? How do you bring another entity, a consciousness, into this world, knowing that, you know, as ironic and wry and dry humorly you might take it now, that at the time it was not exactly pleasant? How do you bring, you know, a grain of sand into the world and say, here, tectonic plates, press against this? The book ends with that question. What do you do next? And do you spend your whole life trying to protect that grain of sand? You know, no. Is my final answer, but the questions about my own childhood percolate, I think, in that final essay, which is why I think it makes it a good cap and a good transition for my next works.
Well, I do not want to give away that last essay because I think it's a magnificent essay, but I will say that it's nervier than you're describing it. I've had friends who have recently had babies and they worry, will I pass along my neuroses and how will I protect my daughter or my son from the world? Not many of them will go into some of the dangers that you actually imagine and think through. Quite, you know, what is it like to look at the desire from the perspective of a child molester? That's some nervy stuff.
Well, and it's important, again, to get back to this idea of perspective and why the research elements are important to the book and why the imported, found material makes its way into the book, is I think it's important to look at everything from different perspectives. And that essay does have, you know, that section where you change point of view and the he turns into a she and an it and they go back and forth. And it does have the point of view of a child molester. Because I think, how do we know how we can only see, I think, the whole picture if we look at it from a lot of point of view. I think, you know, I'm heavily influenced by the Cubists, I guess.
Well, it certainly comes in. I guess that would be one good way to describe the book, actually, now that it occurs to me. I want to go back to your poor mother, as you described her just a second ago. So as I was preparing for the interview, I was reading around, and apparently I found out that you had allowed your mother and your sister to read parts of the book while it was in process to see what they thought.
Yeah, I mean, you have to have a strong family that has a similar attitude to the world as you to let this happen, I think. Because I didn't want, you know, them to go in and say, no, you cannot talk about me, no, delete this. I wanted them to have sort of first dibs over how they, over their reaction to the book. And so, you know, my sisters read it and they're so supportive and they've read everything I've written and they, you know, they give me feedback. In my mom's case, you know, she can get sort of silent sometimes, when I give her material and she says, oh, I love it, but she doesn't go into the text in particular. And so, before I sent this, you know, as a final draft to my publisher, I asked my mom to edit it. And because first of all, she is an English major, so she has very good grammatical skills. And second of all, I thought if she gets into the book from that sort of perspective, she will be able to encounter it with that same sort of distance that I feel that as a writer, you can take on it. And I think it worked to some degree. I mean, she's much more, she brought me into her book club to talk about the book. She's gone to every reading that's been anywhere near Salt Lake City. She's, you know, had parties for me to sell the book. I think she's been so supportive of it, even though, you know, she's featured in it. She's featured, I think, generally positively, but there's still parts, you know, that you don't necessarily want your book club friends to know about. And she's been like, forget it. This is my daughter. This is her book. And this is the comma splice that I fixed. And I think in doing that, it gave her some ownership to it that made her feel like she was in control of the situation and not just sort of smacked around by the spine of the book.
I think it's just a wonderful counterexample or countermodel to the kind of myth that surrounds the writing of the memoir, especially a memoir that might deal with family hardships or family secrets about, you know, truth telling and pain and, you know, the need for self-protection. I mean, I think suddenly you see a writer who's like, I'm going to write this, and not only am I going to write this, but I'm going to have kind of the moral openness to invite people who are in it to contribute before it's done. And I think there's a kind of generosity of spirit there in the creation of the book itself.
Well, and I have to thank that, you know, them for being so generous to do it. And again, it goes along with that same sort of aesthetic that the more perspectives, the better. So, you know, in a lot of ways, they'll help. And they'll say, oh, don't you remember that one time? Blah, blah, blah. Oh, I totally forgot about that. And, I, you know, it gives more detail and richness to the book, I think, because of it.
And it flies nicely into the face of kind of the romantic with a capital R myth of the author as someone who cuts themselves off from the world and creates their perfect art object and, you know, sends it out to be praised. I think, essays, in my experience, are messy things, and kind of it's much nicer to throw a party when you make them.
Absolutely. And I think it's a testament too to the sort of workshop model, which, you know, is derided often enough, but I think is ridiculously derided, because just like everything, it's a collaborative experience. Living in the world is collaborative. Writing about it is collaborative. And, you know, one thing I miss more than anything is having that workshop to bounce things off of people and to say, what is your reaction to this? You know, writing in a hollow box is not entirely process of writing. It's the one half, and waiting for the reader is the part that goes away when you graduate from your, you know, writing program. And something that I think my students really appreciate, the idea that this is my audience. I will at least have 12 people as an audience in my lifetime. Yay.
It is. It's very heartening, especially for young writers.
Exactly.
But even for older writers, at last I got a Goodreads review. Someone paid attention.
Exactly. Again, it's like people like you, I'm like, oh my goodness, thank you so much for reading my book, let alone doing this interview. It's pretty great.
Well, you had mentioned a moment ago that this book has set you up very nicely for the project that you're working on next. What can readers expect after the memoir?
Well, I have another memoir-like book that I'm finishing that does goes sort of directly answers some of the questions in the last essay in the book, Where the Wild Things Are, and talks about, you know, how do you raise kids with so much advice from the internet, from what to feed them to how to play with them interactively for at least 45 minutes a day, including, you know, but really based on this idea of food and how we manipulate food and worry about food and worry about food production, and you're sort of building these children out of food. So it has that same sort of absurdity, I think, about it as Quench does. It's called Salmon of the Apocalypse, and it wonders, why would you have children? When now everything you do is a question mark as opposed to a certainty, and you're never sure if this is, you know, is this too much salt, or is this too much sugar, or, oh, we can just eat raspberries for the rest of our lives. And that idea of it's always impending disaster. No matter what you choose, you will choose wrong. And I sort of, you know, that again, love that aesthetic that you're doomed anyway, so you might as well sort of just sit down and enjoy it. And then I want another book called Microcosm that's much different. It's not as memoiristic, and it's more challenging in that way because it uses much more of the research elements to make an argument about how the tiny things in our lives are really the answer to some of our larger questions. So it's an environmental book in some ways, talking about how, for instance, microorganisms, if you put them in polluted water polluted by fertilizer runoff that has too many nitrates in it, the microorganisms can turn the nitrates into nitrogen oxide. But of course, I'm still me, and so stories about my worries and my obsessions pop in all the time and interrupt that research. So it's almost an inverse of the way that I wrote Quench, is that I begin with the research, and then I'm like, but what about me? Let's talk about me some more. And then interrupted by these tiny micro essays. So again, it's another book where the form of the book is somewhat the content. So there's these long essays, these big ideas, but the really tiny essays are the ones that are trying to answer those big questions, these tiny ideas.
Well, let me ask you a question as a friendly skeptic and fellow essayist who finds this question directed at himself. So we certainly live in an age of specialty. There are certainly specialists out there who are trafficking in information about microorganisms and how they work and what they do and what we should be doing and how we should be utilizing them. And here you are, the essayist, right? And you're taking up this topic and not only doing, say, science writing that popularizes the work that true scientists are doing, but you're willing to sprinkle in some personal stories along with this, you know, serious research. I'll say it as I've gotten it before. How dare you, Nicole?
Absolutely. And I think I get that a lot. Like, what do you think you're talking about? My feeling is the messier I make it, the more I make it my own. Jennifer Senor has this great essay in that Flash nonfiction book that from Rose Metal Press that Dinty Moore put together. And she says that voice, you know, we talk about atmosphere and we talk about mood and tone and sentence length and word choice is all elements of voice. But she has this brilliant moment where she says voice comes from knowing your subject well. And I love that idea. And yet, you know, when I'm working on this science stuff, I know this not at all. And so to make it so I have a voice and so that I own it, I do have to mess it up. And so I try not to spin it as a scientific book about science, but in fact, a investigation about how we adapt or how even I adapt to the difficulties of having to, you know, ride my bicycle to work today instead of drive my car. That these small everyday occurrences, that's the stuff I know, right? That's the stuff that I can own and voice. And so to get to that material and to pretend I own it or to approximate owning it or get anywhere near it, I have to use that avenue of the memoir or the essay and say, this is the stuff I do. And I can get close to it, and I have to back away, you know, but I'll come to it again from another perspective and see if I can approach it at all into making it make sense, not just for me, but for other people, you know, not make the science make sense, but the big idea that small things are important, which is, again, you know, comes from the poet's perspective, that the, you know, pay attention to the every moment, sort of a even Buddhist thought that if you can live in the moment, the big questions fall away, or the big questions answer themselves, possibly. Anyway.
Yes, I often think scholarship will usually start at the moment that the mess has been solved, and the essay is just really happy to wade into the mess as it exists, and that's where most of us live anyway.
Exactly. Exactly. I sense community in that mess. Like, look at all this disaster. And that, you know, there's some, you want to show some, that you have some structural analysis about that disaster. But in the end, the mess is the best meeting ground I can find.
Nicole Walker, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Eric. This has been great. I appreciate it. And I look forward to talking with you more in the future.
This is Eric LeMay, and you've been listening to an interview with Nicole Walker, author of Quench Your Thirst with Salt, on the New Books Network.